Right now, we're inside a computer program.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Are we living in a simulation?
This is the construct. It's our loading program. We can load anything from clothing to equipment, anything we need.
How would we tell the real world from a simulated world?
Maybe there would be telltale signs, like those glitches in the Matrix when things repeat themselves.
And maybe there would be telltale signs, like those glitches in the Matrix when things repeat themselves.
What did you just say?
Nothing, just had a little deja vu.
If we could never know either way, what difference would it make?
Just because something is digital doesn't mean it's not real.
Our guest is David Chalmers, author of Reality Plus, Virtual Worlds and the Problems of Philosophy.
Of course we want to know Reality Plus, all of reality.
What is real? How do you define real?
Are we living in a simulation?
Whoa.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. If we were all living in a simulation, how would we know?
Wouldn't there be telltale signs?
If we did learn that nothing is real, would that make our lives meaningless?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming to you via the studios of KLW San Francisco Bay Area.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today we're asking, are we living in a simulation?
Yeah, that's a great question, Ray. Maybe we're all in the Matrix. We're all, like, hooked up to a bunch of machines and being fed a computer-generated illusion.
Yeah. Or maybe we're in a version of The Truman Show, where the objects you see are real, but the people are all just actors pretending to be your friends.
The thing is, though, I just don't see how we could know for sure either way. I mean, what's to say you're not a figment of my imagination, cunningly crafted by our robot overlords?
Hey, I don't feel like a figment of your imagination. Wait, maybe you're a figment of mine.
Well, I know I'm real. I mean, it's like Descartes said, even when you doubt everything else, your very doubt shows you exist. Cogito ergo sum and all that.
Well, yeah, but Descartes also says that everything is real. He starts out in radical doubt, but at the end of the day, he thinks we can have genuine knowledge based on our senses and our reason.
I think he was right the first time. His argument for skepticism is way more strong and convincing than his argument for certainty. He had that great thought experiment of the evil demon, who keeps us in a kind of simulation.
Come on, Josh. Evil demons aren't real. We all know that.
Do we, though? Just indulge me for a minute, Ray. Imagine there's an evil demon, and he's created the illusion of all the trees and houses and dogs and cats that you see. How would the world look any different?
Okay. Sure, I wouldn't know the difference if there was an evil demon, but that's not what matters. I wouldn't know the difference if I was dead, either. But right now, I still know I'm not dead. So why can't I be sure that I'm not in a simulation?
Well, think about a world 200 years from now. We'll have computers of unimaginable power. We'll have AI and VR up the wazoo. We'll hopefully have solved our energy problems and have virtually unlimited processing power. A ton of people are going to be using their copious spare time to run fancy simulations.
Sure. Maybe they'll make Martian palaces or relive Pride and Prejudice. That all sounds like great fun. What's your point?
Well, they're probably also going to simulate Philosophy Talk from the year 2023. And that's what makes it so likely that you and I are actually Sims.
We're the real Josh and Ray. All those Sims would just be knockoffs, not the real thing.
That's exactly what a Sim would say. Think about it, Ray. Those future programmers won't just make one simulation of 2023. They'll make thousands. So the chances that you and I, the original Ray and Josh, they're vanishingly small. Sorry to burst your bubble.
Now you're being an evil demon. I can't help believing that I'm real. And even if your argument works, I'm not going to believe its conclusion. Besides, who would want to make thousands of simulations of you?
Okay, that's a fair point. But maybe our guest will help you see that we're probably in a simulation after all. It's David Chalmers, professor of philosophy at NYU.
Are you sure it's not just one of a million simulations of him?
You know what? I'm not.
You've been watching too many movies. And to be fair, there are some great ones out there. So we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to find out how simulated worlds have been depicted in popular fiction. She files this report.
When we think of simulated realities, things like Tron, Star Trek, and The Matrix come to mind.
What's happening?
but the groundwork in TV and film was set long before.
My hand goes right through it.
Take Through the Looking Glass, a novel published by Lewis Carroll in 1871. The main character, Alice, steps through a mirror, entering an alternative reality. The Red Queen tells Alice she can be a white pawn, but she wants to be a queen.
You know what it takes to be a queen?
Tom told me. I have to go all the way from square one to square eight. With your permission.
Along the way, Alice meets Humpty Dumpty.
It can't be anybody else. And how exactly like an egg he is.
It is very provoking to be called an egg. Very.
Through the Looking Glass doesn't have the kind of high tech we associate with simulated consciousness in science fiction. But Lisa Yazyk, who teaches science fiction studies at Georgia Tech, says the novel is like an early experiment of the genre. The story is bound by the rules of a game.
And that's one of the other amazing things that we can do with stories about simulated reality is they're like a funhouse mirror to our own present. They show us the same things, but in a sort of slanted way.
The late 1800s saw a mini boom in simulated reality stories. More people consumed information through mass-mediated forms. New technologies kept shaping fiction. Then, in the 1980s, the genre exploded.
This is the moment as the advent of video games and home computing, and a lot of our other technologies, like music technologies, are miniaturizing, and we can take them places with us, right? You can put on your Walkman headphones and have this little virtual musical world.
It's a Sony.
The father of cyberpunk, William Gibson, published his novel Neuromancer in 1984.
Not only did he provide us with some of the first really exciting adventures in cyberspace, but he actually coined the term cyberspace. So he really gave us the language that we use today to talk about modern simulated realities.
Cyberspace. A consensual hallucination experienced daily by billions of legitimate operators, in every nation, by children being taught mathematical concepts.
Gibson imagines cyberspace as a totally amoral place. It's where criminals, corporations, and petty thieves will hang out in the future.
A graphic representation of data abstracted from banks of every computer in the human system. Unthinkable complexity. Lines of light ranged in the non-space of the mind, clusters and constellations of data.
And now here we are. As artificial intelligence and virtual reality surround us, Lisa Yazyk expects fiction to take a nuanced approach, where technology does not need to symbolize death or the transcendence of humanity, it's just there. If you are interested in dropping into dystopias, try the TV series Black Mirror.
The magnifying glass through which we observe the human condition. Where happiness is an illusion. Here, where the past, present, and future all coexist on the same timeline.
Just ask Alice. It all goes back to that looking glass.
That's it, Dinah. If I had a world of my own, everything would be nonsense. Nothing would be what it is, because everything would be what it isn't.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Go ask Alice.
Thanks for that really fun report, Holly. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs. And today we're asking, are we living in a simulation?
We're joined now by David Chalmers. He's professor of philosophy at New York University and author of Reality Plus, Virtual Worlds and the Problems of Philosophy. Dave, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks. It's great to be back on Philosophy Talk after all these years. You know, the first time around, 20 years ago, I sent the biological version of me. This time I thought, okay, maybe I'll send along the AI model and see how he does.
Very appropriate. But I have to say, Dave, you seem like a thoroughly non-fictional person to me. And I was wondering, what first got you interested in saying we might all be in a simulation?
I actually first encountered this kind of idea of a virtual world through my very first computer game when I was 10 years old. I was at my father's work playing around with the mainframe computer system there, and I came across a file that just said adventure. And I went into this, and I came across this world that I could interact with. It was a giant system of caves underground where I could throw axes and start fights and get treasures. It was Colossal Cave Adventure, which was actually one of the first ever video games. And from there, that was my first virtual world. Then I started, you know, video games got better and more sophisticated. We started getting online social worlds. We started getting virtual reality headsets and so on. And this just makes this whole idea of a virtual simulated world so salient that one simply cannot help but ask the question, could this life I'm living right now be a virtual world? Could it be a simulation? And if it's a simulation, what does that mean?
So, Dave, Josh and I were just arguing about exactly that, whether we're living in a simulation or whether we could be. And I said I'm pretty sure we're not, and he disagreed. So who do you think is right?
I can't tell you for sure that we're in a simulation, but I do think it's a serious possibility. I think we could be in a simulation, and I don't think we can rule it out. I actually think, you know, there's a significant chance that we're in a simulation, because it's very likely that many simulations could be made in over the course of universal history. So I guess I side with Josh in thinking it's at least a serious possibility.
All right, so hit me with your best argument that we could be living in a simulation.
Well, I think think of it as a challenge. If someone says, I've got some proof that we're not in a simulation, some evidence that we're not in a simulation, maybe, you know, you think your cat is so cute that this could not possibly be a simulation. I'm going to come back and say that very evidence could itself be simulated. Someone could produce a simulated cat that is just as cute as your real cat. Actually, in your case, I know it's a dog. So it's a simulated dog as cute as your real dog. Now, I would say any evidence you think you have that you're not in a simulation could itself be simulated. So you can't be sure.
So that seems like a pretty powerful argument, because there are lots of other things that I believe besides that I'm not living in a simulation. Like, for instance, that I'm going to be on the radio. But it seems like there is a possible scenario that looks just like this one, where I'm being deceived into thinking that I'm on the radio and I can't tell the difference. Like, what if you all were playing a giant prank on me? How would I know? So does this argument just generate the conclusion that I don't get to know anything I think I know?
I don't think it does, actually. And, you know, one reason is that I don't think, some people think that the idea that we're in a simulation is a scenario where everything I believe is false and nothing is real. That's not my view of a simulation. I think we could be in a simulation. But if we are in a simulation, nevertheless, my view is much of what we believe in still actually exists. You know, I still have a family. I still live in New York. I'm still wearing shoes and so on. All those things, I think, are still happening inside a simulation. So many people have seen the simulation idea as a route to skepticism, the idea that we don't know anything. But I want to reject that kind of reasoning. Yes, we might be in a simulation, but still, everything may be real.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about living in a simulation with David Chalmers from NYU.
Have you ever been immersed in virtual reality? Did it make you question your everyday perceptions? How could you tell the difference between the real world and a sophisticated simulation?
Cogito ergo sim? Along with your comments and questions, when Philosophy Talk continues. If nothing were real in our entire world, would living be easy? I'm Josh Landy. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're asking whether we could be living in a simulation with David Chalmers from NYU, author of Reality Plus.
Got questions about life in a computer program? Email us at comments@philosophytalk.org or comment on our website. And while you're there, you can also become a subscriber and explore our unsimulated library of more than 500 episodes.
So, Dave, you've just told me that if we're living in a simulation, the world is much as we think it is. We don't lose all of our knowledge. How can that be? Tell me more about that.
Yeah, there's a tradition of thinking that simulations are merely a fake or fictional reality, that if we're in a simulation, then none of this is real. I want to say that we could be in a simulation. Nevertheless, if we're in a simulation, all this is real. Here's how I think about it. If we're in a simulation, we're living in a world where the objects around us are made of computer processes. The data structures ultimately made of bits inside a computer. But the digital, just because something is digital, doesn't mean it's not real. We now live in a highly digital world, but we all know digital processes are real. And I want to apply that digital way of thinking, if you like, digital metaphysics, to thinking about the whole idea of a simulation. If we're in a simulation, we're in a world where objects are made of bits, but that doesn't mean they're not real.
I mean, that makes sense to me. After all, you know, a sculptor can make a statue. Just because it's made doesn't mean it isn't real. So I take that point. But I guess my question is that all the reality that we want? I mean, go back to the Matrix scenario, right? If any listener hasn't seen the Matrix, the basic setup is that human beings have been enslaved by a bunch of robots, machines, and their bodies are kept as sort of battery packs while they're fed a kind of consistent illusion, which is the world as we know it. So in that case, in that scenario, where at least some of us get the choice to wake up and experience the what most of us would call the real reality, well, we kind of, that's the reality we want, right? So at least, you know, some of the characters in the movie don't want to sit and live in this other reality. Even if it is real in a certain kind of sense, it's not the level of reality they want. It's not real enough. And they certainly, before they get to wake up, they certainly don't have access to all of the reality of the world, right? They don't have access to the architect's world, the designer's world. So would it really, I mean, if we were systematically kept out of the architect's world, if there were no red pill to swallow, would it be enough of the real?
Yeah, I'm certainly not saying that being in the Matrix is great. You know, being enslaved and deceived, that's not great. Being imprisoned, that's not great. But I want to say that's not a function just of this being digital or virtual. I mean, just so you had a version of the Matrix where we were still in the physical world, but they locked us away on Earth and, you know, deceived us that somehow this was the whole universe and kept us from getting away from the Earth. Then likewise, if we then discovered, there's a giant universe beyond this, of course we'd want to experience that. We want to know all of reality. But that wouldn't mean that your life on Earth was not real. It's still perfectly real. So that's kind of my view of life in the Matrix. You're experiencing a real world. Your life may well be highly meaningful as far as it goes. You're still having interactions with your family, with your friends, with your colleagues, but you're being confined and imprisoned in a small part of reality. Reality is far bigger than what we're experiencing right now. You know, reality is what I call reality plus. And of course we want to know reality plus, all of reality, not just the little reality we have here. But it doesn't mean that our corner of reality, even in the Matrix, it doesn't make it unreal.
So I can kind of get my head around this for some aspects of virtual reality. So take like a virtual strawberry that's actually just made of like a string of zeros and ones, but is piped into my brain and tastes like a strawberry as far as my senses are concerned. Like, I don't care so much about that. I can still interact with it. It still causes the great strawberry taste wherever like tastes are made in my mind. But when I think about sort of simulated friendship, like people who seem to all purposes, like as far as I can see, like my friends, but who aren't like my friends inside, that really bothers me. Do you think that like there are things that can be faked and still be fake, and other things that can't be faked because like the supposed fakes or simulations would be real? Like, how do I draw that distinction, if that's a good distinction at all?
I mean, some people worry about, say, non-player characters inside a simulation. You know, there are the biological beings who are really hooking up to a video game. People think that's real. And then there are the simulated beings, and people think that's fake. My view is that even a simulated being can really, in a certain sense, be perfectly real. Here, the key question, actually, a lot of the time comes down to consciousness. are, say, simulated beings, non-player characters inside a virtual world, conscious beings with genuine conscious experiences of things like love and friendship, genuine emotions, genuine attitudes. And, you know, some people might think that a merely simulated being couldn't be conscious and is incapable of genuine love. That's not my view. I don't think consciousness and emotion are merely purviews of the biological. I think, you know, non-player characters, purely simulated beings can have love and emotion too. In The Matrix, we have we have Neo and Trinity, who are biological beings, hook up to The Matrix. We have the agents, who are simulated beings. But I think even on a proper analysis, even those simulated beings are capable of friendship too. So I think simulated friendship can be genuine friendship.
So you remember this replica AI companion that was in the news a while ago? Because it got yanked from some markets. So it's kind of an AI like boyfriend or girlfriend that's completely artificial. It texts you nice boyfriendy or girlfriendy things. It might text you some spicy things if you pay extra, which I think was part of the legal issues that the company ran into. But I don't think that Replica is a real boyfriend or a girlfriend. Like, I don't think that Replica is conscious. Am I wrong? Or are you saying that, you know, you could have a virtual boyfriend or girlfriend who is conscious, but you can also have some virtual things that are not conscious? Like, what do we say about Replica?
I think you're probably right about Replica. I mean, AI is moving fast, but it's still relatively primitive. I think the consensus would be that we don't yet have conscious AI systems, certainly not human-level conscious AI systems. I mean, ChatGPT and the like are impressive, and who knows whether we might get there soon, but we're probably not there yet. So Replica, I would say, is probably a non-conscious simulation of a conscious system, you know, impressive enough to really get a lot of people's emotions going. And some people do report falling in love with their Replica. But I'd say right now, that's not really a warranted emotion, because this is not really a conscious system. But fast forward 20 years to when we really have genuine human-level artificial intelligence, which is conscious, which is capable of genuine emotion, I don't see any obstacle to that. And at that point, I don't see why a human could not, in principle, have a genuine relationship with an AI system, perhaps in a robot body, perhaps in a virtual world.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about living in a simulation with David Chalmers from NYU. So Dave, you were just talking about what's going to happen in 20 years' time, 50 years' time. But let's think about the present again. Some people have argued that we should actually believe that we're already living in a simulation, making these interesting arguments that Ray and I were talking about at the beginning of the show. And others say, well, look, Occam's razor, what's actually more likely, that we're experiencing reality or that our descendants have made 1,000 simulations of Philosophy Talk in the year 2023? So where are you on that? Do you think there's some evidence, even if it's not conclusive, that sort of nudges us in the direction of thinking we're already in a giant simulation? Or do you think there's some kind of evidence going the other direction? What kind of evidence would you want to give?
Yeah, I mean, some people often say, is this simulation idea just a warmed over version of Descartes' evil demon? I think, you know, the one extra thing that maybe gets added with the simulation idea is the idea that modern science and technology have shown us how these simulated worlds can, in principle, quite easily be constructed and might be constructed on quite a widespread scale. So suddenly, you know, we have simulated worlds everywhere. And, you know, every video game involves a simulated world. Virtual reality technology is getting better and better. Apple has just announced their Vision Pro, a virtual reality headset, which is going to lead to more and more sophisticated interaction with virtual worlds. Suddenly, this has taken an idea which was just a way out philosophical hypothesis in, say, Descartes, and given us a concrete path to seeing how simulations may and very likely will be constructed. And suddenly it seems you can imagine that over the course of history, there's going to be, in every non-simulated world, there will be thousands or millions of simulated worlds constructed. You know, from a statistical viewpoint, it starts to seem as if it may even be quite likely we're in a simulation. So I do take that line of reasoning Seriously.
I get that, you know, and I have to say, it doesn't totally persuade me. But my favorite argument in favor of us being in a simulation is Borges's. Borges said, we've dreamt the world collectively. We've dreamt it as firm, mysterious, visible, ubiquitous in space, and durable in time. But in its architecture, we have allowed tenuous and eternal crevices of unreason, which tell us it is false. He points to Zeno's paradoxes. He points to Kant's antinomies. He says, look, clearly somebody made that. There are glitches in the matrix. Do you like that kind of argument?
This is a world created by an imperfect God. Yeah. Some people say that the intelligent design of the universe is a sign that all this was created. The alternative view is the dumb design argument.
Yes.
This world is so bad, that it must have been designed by some kind of idiot.
It doesn't add up. The physics doesn't add up.
Philosophy is so hard. How did consciousness even get in there? It's like, man, this world is such a bizarre place.
So, okay, if I can take a step back, I think I'm losing a little bit of sight of what a simulation is. Like, is a simulation just anything that was designed to create experience in thinking beings? Does a simulation have to be a representation of something that it is not? Like a simulated apple is based on a real apple. So what is it that we might be living in?
I think that's our basic idea of a simulation, which is a simulation is somehow a simulation of some further system, like an apple or indeed a universe. So you could have an unsimulated physical world, but then we could have a computer system that simulates that physical world digitally, with digital processes that somehow mirror the physical processes in the world that we're simulating. But actually, it was Baudrillard in his book Simulation and Simulacra who distinguished various degrees of simulation, from a simulation that actually simulates something which is out there and real and actually happened, like, you know, a simulation of the Big Bang or the Second World War, to simulations that simulate things that never happened at all, for which there's no corresponding reality. Like, we could simulate a 26-dimensional universe with totally different laws of physics that don't actually exist in our world. So I think all those are simulations.
Dave, we have a comment from Harold on our website. Harold says, if we were in a simulation, anything in the way of nihilism would be pointless because it would simply be a fact that nothing mattered. What do you think about that, Dave? Does nothing matter if we're in a simulation?
I think things still matter if we're in a simulation. As long as we're, you know, conscious beings, I think consciousness comes with the ability to, you know, to find meaning and value in the world. You know, we invest physical objects, biological systems, and so on with meaning stemming at least from our consciousness. And I think we can invest digital systems with meaning too. And if we're in a simulation, everything that I take to matter in this world, I think, still matters. My family matter, my friends matter, doing science matters, doing philosophy matters. Philosophy talk still matters.
So I love this idea that consciousness matters. What does it take for something to be conscious? So you said that digital beings could be conscious as well. What does it take and how do we know?
That's a tiny little question that I've never thought about before. But yeah, this is my day job. And we have not figured out consciousness yet. And you know, no one has a good theory of it. But I'm very strongly of the view that the substrate, say the biological substrate of consciousness, is not essential. That what we do with a biological brain could in principle be done in a silicon brain. If you changed out my neurons one at a time for silicon chips functioning the same way, then that system would still be conscious. And if that's possible, then it starts to look like consciousness in a simulated system ought to be possible as well. It's true that we don't know how brains give you consciousness, so we don't know how it works, but as long as there's reasons to think digital systems can be conscious, then it looks like there can be consciousness and indeed meaning in a digital world.
Yeah, I should point out Dave is famous for having coined the term the hard problem of consciousness, which is how we get precisely from matter to consciousness. But let's get back to the nihilism question, if that's all right. I mean, why? You're saying, okay, look, we might be in a simulation without realizing. We might even somehow figure out one day that we're in a simulation. Either way, it doesn't matter that much. We don't have to feel like our life is meaningless. We still have lots of areas in which we sort of create meaning. Does this sort of place you in the existentialist camp? Is this a little bit analogous to what the existentialists say about our mortality? Yes, we're all mortal. That's not a great fact about our lives. It places many of our projects in jeopardy. And yet, it's within our power to imbue our lives with meaning. Is there an analogy there to what you're saying about the awareness that we may be in a simulation?
It's an interesting idea, and I'm not really an expert on existentialism, but I do like the idea that we create our own meaning and we invest our lives, imperfect as they are, with meaning. Even if we're in one tiny corner of a giant universe, our relationships still matter. And the same is true if we're in a simulation. I mean, just say we did discover overnight that we're in a simulation. I'm not saying this would be nothing, of course. That would be a massive discovery. Oh my God, our reality is ultimately digital. There's more universe out there than we possibly knew. Someone created all this. I mean, all this would have massive reverberations in our worldview. But at the end of the day, I think, we would still go back to our families and our friends and our occupations and so on, and they would continue to be meaningful. We'll continue to have meaningful conscious experiences in our interactions with others, and that's ultimately where the meaning in a life comes from, I think.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about living in a simulation with David Chalmers from NYU, author of Reality Plus.
What kinds of simulation does the future have in store for us? Could sophisticated virtual worlds lead us to neglect the real one? Or could they save us from its horrors?
When virtual worlds get real. Plus, commentary from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher, when Philosophy Talk continues. Maybe I'm not living in the real world, but will I ever know for sure? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Our guest is David Chalmers from NYU, and we're asking, are we living in a simulation?
So Dave, we've got an email from Mary. Mary writes, with all the media and social platforms we have now, it's amazing everyone doesn't live in a simulation of some kind. In this day and age, I'd be afraid of my own shadow if I listened to all the social network media. So I strive to just enjoy every moment and not be influenced by any of that. So what do you think, Dave? Is the world of social media already a kind of simulation?
It's certainly it's a highly digital world, and we're interacting in a digital environment. I mean, standard social media like, Facebook and Twitter and Instagram don't have full-scale simulated worlds at their core in the way that, say, like Minecraft or Fortnite or Second Life. Those actually have 3D worlds that your avatars are hanging out in. In Facebook and Twitter, we don't quite have that. Mind you, on Instagram, people, cultivate the appearance of their lives in a way that might have some element of simulation. But I think we're gradually moving in the direction of more and more immersive social worlds. When Mark Zuckerberg renamed Facebook to Meta, this was to mark their ambitions of creating the so-called metaverse, which is supposed to be a giant network of immersive three-dimensional virtual worlds that people will hang out in. I think they see that as the future of social media. And I think one can see that is having the potential for all the upsides and all the downsides of social media just squared once it's a world that we hang out in.
Dave, when we're talking about simulation, how important is the kind of 3D immersion? So what I've seen of virtual reality is that the 3D immersion is actually really focused on the sense of vision. And I kind of wonder about other aspects of simulation, some of which you can get with really old technologies. Mm-hmm. Like reading a novel kind of immerses you emotionally in a character's world and kind of builds out that world, even though it's really low tech. And putting on a VR headset, if you have vision that can get and be plugged into the VR headset gives you a visual representation. But I wonder how much of the tech is actually necessary to have a simulated world. Like, aren't there already low-tech simulated worlds?
It's interesting. Yeah, a standard definition of virtual reality that I like is that it's an immersive, interactive, computer-generated world, where the key thing is, I suppose, that it's computer-generated, but it's also important to be immersive, 3D all around you, and interactive. You can interact with it. And then you can ask question, how important are each of those conditions? For example, is it important that it be 3D? I mean, most people these days who interact with virtual worlds don't do so with a 3D headset. They play video games like Fortnite and Minecraft, typically on a 2D screen. But they're still interacting with a computer-generated world. And I think a lot of the things that we say about virtual worlds might apply to those 2D screen-based worlds. I mean, I think being interactive is important, though. Being interactive means you can act back. If I go to a movie, I'm immersed in it, but I don't actually make a difference to what happens in the movie. And arguably, I think, you know, reading a novel is a bit like that. I'm a passive consumer of what happens in the novel. I don't act back on it. I mean, there is interactive fiction, of course. And if you soup up your novel with genuine interaction, or maybe with enough imagination, then you can get some kind of immersive or interactive world on top of that. But I do think interaction and agency is very important. I don't know to what extent you get that with, say, a movie or a novel.
So I like your point about interaction and agency. I think there are some low-tech virtual realities that have that without the kind of visually immersive thing. So something like Dungeons and Dragons, which I realize I'm saying things about my own cultural position by mentioning it.
I remember back in the 1970s when D&D first came out, Colossal Cave Adventure. It was a text adventure, no 3D immersion. It was still a real virtual world.
Yeah. The example you started with, in fact. Also, fan fiction strikes me as a kind of interactive way of engaging with novels and movies.
Yeah, these are great examples, I think, of extremely healthy interactions with virtual worlds. But of course, they're not all consuming, right? I mean, this is sort of my bread and butter, right? These sort of fictional worlds, whether the more passive experience, although it's not totally passive, of watching a movie, or the more interactive experience of fan fiction or the, you know, adventure games and so on. I think these are all delightful, pleasing, and in many cases, important aspects of our lives, but just aspects. However, if we get to a Matrix-like future, I like it that you're sanguine, and maybe that's a good thing because maybe we don't have a choice and we better be happy about it. But I wonder, think back to the scenario that Ray was sketching out earlier where we're all playing a prank on them. You know, we're telling Ray, you're going to be on the radio. And we put them in a room somewhere with headphones, and, you know, we all sort of make it seem like they're on the radio. And then at some point we say, Ray, you weren't really on the radio. Ha ha, the joke's on you. Surely at that point, Ray's going to think, well, geez, that wasn't real. And whatever stock I put into that, whatever meaning I put into that, whatever value I thought that contributed to my life, that kind of evaporates. And so if that's true for a local situation, like a hoax or a prank or even an evil demon tricking you for 5 minutes, why shouldn't it also be true if we're in a global simulation that covers everything in our entire lives from birth to death? Why shouldn't we be a bit demoralized by that?
I don't know that everything that looks like a hoax has to be a hoax. I mean, just say we got a newfangled digital radio, and Ray thinks they're on analog radio, the old-fashioned kind, and we say, aha, you weren't really on you weren't really on radio because you were just on this digital radio. So, this is a hoax. I think, you know, Ray might reasonably have the reaction. Well, digital radio is radio too. It's still real. It's still meaningful. And that's roughly my attitude about virtual worlds. Someone might think they're fake or fictional, but they're perfectly real. And by the way, the ones that lie in our future are kind of unlike the Matrix world does involve an element of deception. People in the Matrix don't know they're in the Matrix. But virtual worlds that we step into with clear eyes in the future, you know, when you enter Minecraft, you know you're in Minecraft. In the future, when we enter the metaverse, we'll know we're in the metaverse. I think there needn't be any deception involved there.
A simulation kind of by its nature copies some aspects of the thing it's simulating, or like the thing that the imaginary thing that would exist that it would be simulating if it existed, I guess, when you're simulating something not real. And like some of those aspects are important and some of them aren't. So medical simulations where people can learn to do surgery without having a real body to do surgery on, it seems like it's really important to capture sort of the spatial relationships between different parts of the body. You would have messed up if you didn't do that. But it's maybe not so important to capture like the exact color of things. How do you decide which parts of something are important to capture in a simulation and like what gets you the value?
Yeah, I guess it depends on your purposes in building the simulation. Like if you're building a simulation for scientific purposes, as happens today a lot, then okay, well, it depends what we're trying to understand. If we want to understand, you know, the history of the cosmos since the Big Bang, we'll simulate things at one level. If you want to understand the dynamics of cells, we'll simulate at another level. If we're doing our simulations for history or for prediction of the future, it'll depend what we're trying to predict. If we're actually doing this to build a universe for us to live in the future, like, you know, as in the so-called metaverse, I mean, it needn't be a matter of simulating existing reality at all. We might want to build wholly new worlds with wholly new capacities. Yeah, if there are some things about ordinary reality that we like aspects of having a body, then great, let's keep those aspects. But we can also have, you know, wholly new bodies or wholly new ways of inhabiting a world. And if these are worlds we're going to live in, I think we should be open to throwing away many aspects of existing reality and creating new ones.
So what if I disagree with the creators of the metaverse about what's important to capture? So what if I have physical objects that are really important to me, and the creators of the metaverse say, well, we can give you like digital replicas of those physical objects. And I say, but those don't have the history. Am I wrong? Are they wrong?
I don't think it's a matter of right or wrong. You know, different people have different values and different preferences. And some people really value nature, for example. They really value being out there in a natural environment that's not artificial and not constructed. And such a person might reasonably have a preference for living in natural reality as opposed to virtual reality. But, you know, not everyone has that preference. I spend most of my time in New York City, and it's not terribly natural, but it's still pretty meaningful. I also think that in the metaverse, I hope there's more than one metaverse. The utopian version here is there's many different virtual worlds, and people can choose the kind of virtual world that they want to hang out in, or if they prefer. No one should be forced to live in a virtual world. People can live in the natural world too. So I'd like to think that in principle, you know, there could be an ecosystem of both bits of physical reality and bits of virtual reality with something for everybody.
Dave, I have to say before we let you go that I loved your book. It's fascinating, not just about virtual reality, but all kinds of other philosophical questions. And one of the things I like particularly is how it traces a kind of a history of philosophizing on this topic. We've gone from the cave to the demon to the vat to the simulation. You talk about Hinduism, Taoism, Plato, Descartes, Kant, Hilary Putnam. Is there something distinctive about today's thinking on these questions that sets it apart from this long tradition of wondering whether the world might be radically different from the way it appears?
Well, what is it they say? All philosophy is footnotes to Plato. So I guess all this is footnotes to Plato's cave and to Zhuangzi's butterfly dream and to Descartes' evil demon and... you find these ideas everywhere. But I do think, you know, the technological aspect adds at least a little bit. I mean, first of all, the idea of a computer simulation is now concretely anchored in the idea of a digital system, which is something we've built up a whole theoretical way of thinking about that makes these ideas concrete. And also the fact that this technology is now actually starting to exist takes these way out philosophical ideas and makes them real. You can now enter a simulated world on a virtual reality headset. Once Meta have their product, Google's working on glasses, Apple has the Vision Pro. Before long, everyone's actually going to be in these systems, interacting with them. And that makes these philosophical questions, previously hypothetical, now suddenly very much actual. And I think that makes a philosophical difference.
Dave, it's been real, I think, anyway. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks. It's been meaningful for me.
Our guest has been David Chalmers, professor of philosophy at New York University and author of Reality Plus, Virtual Worlds and the Problems of Philosophy. So, Ray, what are you thinking now?
Well, I'm thinking that some simulated realities have quite a lot of potential for creating meaningful connections. I think one amazing thing about the internet is that you can have conversations not in person anymore. And I guess an amazing thing about all telecommunications, I think that the simulated realities of fiction are already awesome. So while the metaverse sounds like fun, I think there's already so much rich simulation that we can apply Dave's philosophical ideas to that we shouldn't limit it to just computer simulations.
I really like that idea. And I have to say, I'm also excited about this future that Dave sketches for us, where we'll have a choice of many different simulations that are fully embodied. And maybe I'll get to simulate being out in a beautiful field with the butterflies flying around, which had a dream that they were me or something like that. But what I don't want to be in is the Matrix. But we're going to put links to everything we mentioned today on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature it on the blog.
Now, only a simulation could talk this fast. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, from what I've read, virtual reality requires goggles, headsets, special gloves, avatars, 3D landscaping, intricate color palettes, maybe hallucinogens, hypnotism, teams of developers, and it's still not entirely convincing, unless you think, wow, it seems so real, it's the same thing as reality. Sometimes the real doesn't seem real. That's also proof that it is. Surrealism is its own reward, you might say, and we have therapy and therapeutic drugs, also loved ones, to remind us that life, friends, is boring, as John Berryman put it. That's why we have Disneyland and sex, to put spice in the mundane. VR may be too much spice. Wear the VR helmet to the bus, you could get run over. It needs a viewing distance. And for VR to be convincing, strangely, you also need proof that it's not real. A trompe l'oeil painting, for instance, is art designed to replicate an aspect and dimension, an actual thing. But you also want to see the brushstrokes. You don't actually want people falling out the painted window by mistake. That would mean emergency rooms, lawsuits. The presence of lawyers is always a surefire reality indicator. Summing up so far, VR must have a creator, a signature, a trademark, a style choice. If we don't see that, it's probably real. Belief in a creator or even meaning is not necessary to perceive reality. Yet we love to believe and we love being fooled. In fact, for a nation that loves BS as much as we do, it's weird that we're suddenly worried about it. Now with AI and VR and breakthroughs in propaganda and brainwashing, we've never been bolder in our embrace. An inevitable part of pretty much any belief system, BS takes many forms, and some overlap. Astrology, for example, is followed by all kinds of people. And there might be something to it. There's a kind of metaphor for what makes us tick and what to do about it. Then there's the I Ching and Tarot, not to mention Christianity and psychoanalysis, which actively require faith in order to work. Say what you will about plumbing, it only requires running water and a plunger, usually. You have to have faith in infrastructure, certainly, which seems problematic, as the kids say. Help after a storm or fire either comes too late or with strings, and if climate change is involved, Democrats are blamed for creating COVID or immigration to make sure that we still have Democrats in 2036 when Republicans are busy goose-stepping through Miami on their way to rig the Super Bowl. Delusions depend on whose paranoia you accept. Charles VI of France, the French king from Henry V, for instance, believed he was made of glass. Which kind of a kingly delusion, really. He's there, yet not there. He's the king, but you can see right through him to kings past and future. And history can shatter him like a carnival mirror. People used to believe in flying saucers, or not. Now they believe in unexplained aerial phenomena, or not. Nothing has changed except the little green men, who are now gray humanoids, or not. Many Trump supporters believe he was cheated out of re-election. And many of them acted on this belief on January 6th, or did as if for surety, as Iago put it. With fake news and all, some people worry that we can no longer tell truth from falsity. Though it depends on who you ask and when. Some believe that our world is now a dystopian hellhole, lit by fires set by the woke. The only return to a guy-run way of doing things with sports and boats and feed caps worn backwards can bring us back to our true glory, whenever and whatever that was. Others are just waiting for the true glory of the check to clear so we can buy groceries. So it's a looking glass world, which makes it hard to shave yourself. Of course, Grandma was taken by aliens. She's gone, isn't she? Of course the election wasn't stolen. He's not president, is he? All I can say is, when I was a kid, I was amazed at 3D movies. Somewhere along the line, I lost the glasses. Yet everything still looks so real, which again, is not always the same as reality, which as a rule does not jump off the screen. As a rule, reality just there.
What is reality?
I gotta go.
Thank you.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW San Francisco Bay Area and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2023.
Our executive producer is Ben Trefney. The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Thanks also to Jamie Lee, Elizabeth Zhu, Emily Huang, Merle Kessler, and Angela Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
The font is larger. And Jesus wept. For there were no more worlds to conquer.